wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, folks, that was our homemade Old Mole song by Joe and Clayton. Joe on the guitar, Clayton on the harmonica, both singing. Our original version by Mass Bascom Lamar Lunford had to be placed in the Museum of Infamy when we discovered he was a raging, raving racist. So this is our Old Mole show on KBOO in Portland. We burrow down to uncover the machinations of our elites. And we also expose capitalism's endless appetite. It's in its genes, its basic functioning, to turn everything into profits, including, of course, human labor, and now becoming so clear, devouring nature. And that cannot go on for very much longer. It's likely to have a very grim outcome, with no happy ending, but thankfully there is another story of the mounting challenges on so many fronts to capital's great machine. These many challenges are by us moles, ordinary folks of our extraordinary species, who've created the possibility of that other necessary, possible, democratic, and sustainable world. Anyway, today on The Mole, as every Monday at 9 a.m., we look at those struggles from below. Today we examine Trump and the Iran deal, also Palestine, why Trump withdrew from the agreement, why that's making U.S. banks and financiers nervous, what Russia, China, and Europe might do. Our music today will also look at banking and finance, take a preliminary look at the extent to which the critique of money, banking, and finance has gained expression in popular music. There are more songs than you think, some pretty familiar. Also today, our legal moles go down to the border to discuss the caravan and asylum law. As we say, build that wall, keep Trump out. Our literary mole reviews the novel Girls Gone Brighter by Sobha Rao. Later, I talk with Suzanne Gordon, who will be here in Portland Wednesday evening at the Downtown Unitarian Church at 6 o'clock, discussing veterans' health care and its achievements. First today, Dave Funkel on Trump and the Iran deal, and Trump and Israel, and all the implications. Before that, though, our first song about banking and finance, an old favorite.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Well, that, of course, was 16 Tons. It was the popular version, though, by Tennessee Ernie Ford in 1955. The song was actually written by Merle Travis in 1946. We tried to get the Travis version, but it was when we went to YouTube for all possibilities, and they were so scratchy as to be unhearable. So we paid Tennessee and Ernie Ford. Travis's father was a Kentucky coal miner. The line, you load 16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. It came from a letter written by Travis's brother. Travis attributed another line to his father, the coal miner, who would say, I can't afford to die. I owe my soul to the company's store. In fact, that has a more than a germ of truth. We'll discuss that at the end of the show. All of these songs, and we'll be talking about debt peonage, which the United Mine Workers actually managed through great strikes in the coal field. They formed the union and stopped the coal companies from extracting all the blood of the miners. More on that later. Dave Finkel, welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Dave reads and writes a lot on the Middle East. He's also the editor of the Journal Against the Current. We're going to be talking about the Iran deal, Trump's withdrawal, and the potential consequences, including, of course, a Middle East war. First, though, it's necessary to talk about the Middle East today and the history of Iran. So tell us, Dave, the Nakba is now going on and intensifying. Tell us about it.
Well, I think we have to look at this morning's news in particular. As you may already know, if folks haven't heard, they're just waking up. Several dozen people have been killed today by Israeli fire at the Gaza border fence. In fact, this culminates, you know, several weeks of protests and Israeli killings. The death toll and the casualty count are mounting, but in terms of a historical parallel, what's happening at the Gaza fence today are, of course, on the same day that the U.S. Embassy is opening in Jerusalem to great fanfare and celebration from evangelical fundamentalists and so forth. What's happening at the Gaza fence today really reminds me very much of the South African Sharpeville massacre of 1959. The number of people killed, as I recall, something like 69 or something. The number of injured is going to be very reminiscent. And the Sharpeville massacre was really a defining moment in the long, long struggle to bring down South African apartheid. And I think that today's, in the last several weeks, massacre at the Gaza fence will also historically have that sense of a turning point.
If the people of the world and the nations organize, and that's, of course, the people of the world force the nations to organize. That's part of the struggle of the boycott and sanctions and divestment campaign. Dave, let's talk about now Iran. Give us a little bit of a sense of Iran in Middle East history. The struggle for Iran is a key determinant of how the Middle East is now today. Tell us about it, and especially the destruction of the social democratic government in Iran in 1953 and 54.
Right. Well, this is something that most Americans have forgotten or never learned. But the people of Iran remember it, of course. So it is 1953, an elected government, Prime Minister Mossadegh, was overthrown in a CIA-sponsored coup. The book to read on that subject, by the way, is by the scholar Ervand Abrahamian, and it's called The Coup. It's concise, but it's really very, very good. That brought the Shah of Iran back to power, created a very brutal regime with American support that lasted for 25 years until it was overthrown in the 1979 revolution that produced what is today's Islamic Republic. Brutally repressive, widely hated by much of the Iranian population, but due to a number of factors, including the American invasion of Iraq, which toppled Saddam Hussein's regime, Iran then emerged in a vacuum as the main regional power. So it's against that backdrop that we really have to look at Trump backing out of the Iran deal.
One of the ways that the CIA thought that they were going to stabilize Iran after the coup and destruction of the left and the exiling or the killing of left democratic forces, they thought that they would give more power to the Islamists, that is, really encourage and subsidize the Ayatollahs of the country. And they would, of course, all of the discontent by ordinary people, it would go into sort of religious fantasies of ascending to heaven. It seems to me, to a large extent, the Islamic fundamentalism now in the Middle East is the product of that favoritism in Saudi Arabia and other countries by the U.S. and the support for Islamic fundamentalism.
Well, yes, that's a commonplace story. That's how basically Afghanistan was destroyed in the 1980s. Look, when people hear about horrible fundamentalist terrorist attacks that took place, like, for example, it's happened over this past weekend in Indonesia, it goes on in Pakistan, Afghanistan, these are places where that kind of fundamentalist Islamist, I don't know what to call it, extremism, was not indigenous to those places. It was spread by Saudi money, Saudi influence. Their brand of Islam was exported and mutated into even more extreme forms, and this has been encouraged by the United States and other imperial powers for decades. It's not a new story.
Dave, let's now talk about Trump's withdrawal from the Iran deal.
Okay, well, there is a statement that people might want to look up online. This self-promotion, www.solidarity-us.org, talks about Trump's withdrawal. I want to say two things about that. very importantly. One of the things I learned from one of the great Israeli human rights campaigners and scholars, the late Dr. Israel Shahak, he made a very important point on a number of occasions, which is that when states act in their narrow interests, the interests of their ruling classes, that's dangerous. What's even more dangerous is when they act out of ideological motivation. The United States' withdrawal from the nuclear deal with Iran, JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was a multilateral treaty, in many respects, this withdrawal is ideologically motivated, not only by Trump, but by the extremist war hawks and ideologues that now surround him in his administration. This makes it even more dangerous and sets the Middle East on a potential course to an extremely horrific war. Now, in the immediate aftermath, I'll say, as you've heard, Israel has been bombing Iranian targets in Syria. Iran has been lobbing a few missiles into the Israeli Golan Heights area. Israel and Iran are acting in a very dangerous way, but they're acting according to the logic of their state interests. That's dangerous. But it's not as dangerous as the United States acting, which is the main, of course, which is the largest militarized power in the world. The United States acting out of ideological interests, that's even more dangerous. I don't believe that war between Israel and Iran is likely to break out in the short run. However, the Israeli leadership, for its part, has been trying to maneuver the United States into a military confrontation with Iran for many years. Iran, for its part, has been spreading its influence through much of the Middle East, but is severely overextended, although it's a regional power now. It is overextended, and it has political and economic problems at home, with a collapsing currency, with agriculture devastated by climate change, which is a whole story throughout the Middle East you could do a whole program on. So those are some of the elements, just some of the elements that make the situation so dangerous.
Let's get into what can be done to force these ideologues in the United States who have dreams of conquering the Middle East with their brand of democracy. It's quite crazed, but they talk to one another and they have high priests telling them how wonderful it would be. You pointed out it was ideological interest. It's not economic interest, actually. My sense is that what Trump is doing now, not just the oil barons, although they could make a lot of money if the price of oil really starts spiking. And certainly it's not the people who want to sell things in the Middle East and to Iran. But it's the ideologues who are doing it. And Wall Street actually has to be holding its breath because Trump is using as a cudgel the whole world financial system that the U.S. controls. Tell us that story briefly.
Well, sure. The United States will impose new unilateral sanctions on Iran, and the way to enforce those is by forcing particularly European companies to halt their investments in Iran under the threat of secondary U.S. sanctions, that is, that corporations that invest in Iran will be cut off from the international banking system that the United States dominates. They'll be cut off from doing business with U.S. banks.
And now, they'll be cut off from selling anything in the United States, like Volkswagen,
yeah,
for example.
Now, whether the European Union, which is very fragile and has its own extreme difficulties, whether the European Union is capable of erecting protections for companies that want to do business with Iran under the terms of the nuclear deal with Iran to keep the nuclear deal intact, whether they are able to create a counter system, whether they are able to protect their companies from being cut out of the banking system by the United States and so on, that's all up in the air. It's very, very early to predict whether that will happen.
Yeah, it's very dramatic. If the Europeans bow to the United States on this, it's basically allowing Trump to define their foreign policy.
Yes, and they're very upset about it.
Very upset about it. On the other hand, they may try and put off the time of decision. They may think that the coming election is going to defang Trump and change things some. That's not inconceivable. Dave, what about a peace movement here and around the world?
Well, two things are necessary, okay? We need the revival of a peace movement in the United States, and of course we need a global peace movement. The peace movement in the United States today is not as strong as we would like it to be. I don't believe there's big war sentiment in the population, but the anti-war movement is not as strong as it should be. Among other things, it's divided because some of the political forces, for reasons that are too complicated to go into here, are sympathetic to the Syrian regime, and it's kind of a mess. And many people are looking to the Democrats to somehow get rid of Donald Trump, which is not going to happen, okay? So we need the revival of an anti-war movement. And another thing that's desperately needed as regards the Palestine-Israel situation, we need a very strong, popularly based BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, particularly in regards to the massacre that's going on right now. I know that there is an activist community in Portland that is very active around BDS, and by all means, you should have them on your show talking about what's going on locally, because I know there's important stuff
now,
there.
We do. Dave Finkel, thanks a lot for talking to us today. Keep up the good work, Dave.
Thank you.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home.
Good morning. This is Jan Hawken here with Mike Snedeker this morning, our Left in the Law segment for the month. And we're talking about the caravan of Central American refugees that arrived last month from a long journey, mostly from Honduras, arriving in Tijuana, the border with the USA, and presenting themselves for asylum. The caravan began with support from international refugee organizations, and beginning with about 1,500 people and 200 arrived and are now being processed by the U.S. government as asylum seekers. The Trump administration has issued a what they call a zero-tolerance policy for people entering the country illegally, although international law, including the U.S., does allow for the rights of people as refugees to apply for asylum when they enter a country, including the U.S. So, Mike, tell us about the situation there and what's new under Trump's demonstrably more straightforwardly vicious, hostile, and racist policies versus earlier eras, the Obama administration, and the situation in the 1980s where this was more in the news.
Well, there's not a whole lot that's new, Jan. During the Obama years, there was serious efforts made in 2014 to hinder people from making applications for asylum. Now, the right to apply for asylum is really well settled from laws in 1951 and 1967. The Code of Federal Regulations allows anybody with a well-founded fear of persecution in their home country to present an application for asylum.
And although the evidence that needs to be assembled and presented and how that evidence is evaluated shifts over time and from country to country. Like Canada is much more flexible. What kind of a story you have, how severe, how many witnesses and so on. And most refugees in a situation are not able to put these kinds of materials together. So in some ways, isn't it a theoretical right that has limits in practice?
Well, it's a very real right, very practical right. There are thousands of people in this country now because of it. But, of course, it varies widely according to the politics of the moment. The early 80s were every bit as bad as the law is now. And the people in the Reagan years, when it was hotly contested over battles in El Salvador and Nicaragua, there was intense opposition in this country to our policies there. There were directions from the State Department and from the Department of Justice to hinder people in every way possible from making any applications, and statements from the State Department saying that all these people are economic refugees.
And economic refugees don't meet the criteria for asylum, even though that's a whole other topic, the rights of people who come here under conditions of less immediate threat of death or suffering. But this is a situation in Honduras. Can you say something about why so many of these asylum seekers are from Honduras?
Well, that's what you will never hear from anyone in the Trump administration, is the realities of life in Honduras right now. There was a coup in 2009, strongly supported by Hillary Clinton and by the State Department, that got rid of a lawfully elected president of Honduras. Since then, the economy has deteriorated rapidly. Tourism has plummeted. There's a dictator now who just recently replaced 4 Supreme Court justices because they struck down a policy he liked. We have sent back to Honduras gang members or members of the Mara Salvatrucha or MS-13, the 18th Street Gang. These are people who were created here. They were returned in large numbers to Honduras, where there's no economy, no jobs available at all. They're now surviving with extortions in neighborhoods, kidnappings, and any efforts to oppose the existing regime, and particularly most recently the elections in November of 2017, are met with violence. Police are likely to shoot you in the head if you demonstrate, as they are to respond in any other way. So you've got a decayed society with people in tremendous danger everywhere. People with children being recruited in certain neighborhoods have been essentially abandoned because storekeepers simply can't make it with the extortionate practices that prevail everywhere. So people are trying to get out, trying to stay alive. Those people are the kind of people that make up the caravans that's coming to this country.
But the two get mixed together, right? And so that building a deeper, wider moat around the castle has some basis in the fear of the dangerous places in the world that the U.S. is deeply implicated in, you're saying, in the troubles there and people fleeing those troubles. But do the two get fused around the politics of fear, and that people coming from scary places are going to bring their scary problems, like these gangs? You say there was this history of these gangs.
They were
created in
Los Angeles.
How were they created in Los Angeles?
There were large numbers of people who were allowed in this country from Honduras under temporary status, which is a whole other topic because Trump is about to require a couple of 100,000 Hondurans to return to Honduras next year. But there were large numbers of people who arrived here, had no real place to fit in, became parts of street gangs in L.A., and then were exported en masse back to the countries in which they came. Singled out, separated from their families, like the young males were sent back by the boatload to Honduras and El Salvador. They didn't just evaporate or go away.
And they're not just, as Trump would say, bad dudes. There are histories that are carried through these gangs of abandonment and ways that all of these displacements produce a kind of unruly lawlessness. But the U.S. along the way has contributed to bringing trouble in and sending it back to Honduras.
Well, what's happened at the border is that during the Obama years, various ideas were implemented in order to keep people from applying at all. And that's an area where district court judges and federal courts have been pretty decent. There have been good decisions striking down efforts like, for example, the effort to pay Mexico or have Mexico stop everyone from getting to the border, or detaining people in this country for the purpose of deterring other people to come. Or the most dramatic example was the Haitian boat people. There were efforts to have them blocked from being able to apply for asylum. The courts said, well, you can't do that. They have to be allowed. There's no way to distinguish them from anyone, any other person, from presenting a claim that they have a well-founded fear of persecution if they were to be returned.
So how is the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions trying to make life harder now for those asylum seekers applying for asylum in the U.S.?
Well, they have a couple of strategies. One is the bad dude strategy, but Mike Pence is blaming it all on rotten immigration lawyers and scheming media. He's saying that those people are to be pitied. All those people in the caravan, the real enemies here are is the media in this country, and agenda-driven media members and political hacks who are trying to exploit all these people.
Well, so, that must mean there's some protest going on around it and some support. So what's happening on that front? That's what that usually means.
Well, there are. There's a group called Pueblo Sin Fronteras, which were people without frontiers who are helping people in every way they can. There are lots of attorneys and groups on the ground who work on both sides of the border in Tijuana and San Diego.
And there was quite a presence of support at the border around that wall that is becoming real as it's erected, but also a symbol of a whole state of mind, a reactionary state of mind. But apparently there are some wonderful images of that online.
Yeah, they're trying various ways. One is to just completely bog down the whole asylum process.
Mm-hmm.
And what people then do is enter the country illegally and present themselves to the Border Patrol rather than in the appropriate pre-established ways of presenting their claims. It used to be that would work more or less because your asylum claim would be considered before any criminal charge of illegal entry. But now Sessions has reversed that. And with his detention policy, he's pretty direct in saying that we hope to, by implementing this family separation policy, to have a zero tolerance policy for any sort of illegal activity to discourage people from crossing the border and to discourage people from making an application for asylum.
Yeah, I always like that line, some famous song, we're all illegal versus we're all legal, that we've all illegally entered somewhere. And the whole question of what's legal and what's not for border crossers is brought to the fore here as the Trump administration plays so recklessly with that idea. So in closing, anything more you want to say before we'll continue following the asylum seekers next month? Anything you'd like to add and where people can follow this? I know you have colleagues who are working as attorneys with asylum seekers, and it's an important form of work.
Well, there will be continued struggles on the border, and legally it's a big battle because you do have to make a detailed showing of your own subjective feelings and the objective realities back where you come from. And if you're not a member of a minority, you've got to show that you are in particular are in danger. And the amount of documents required varies from judge to judge. And like the law in general or criminal law, it's wildly different from according to which judge is going to consider your case.
Uh-huh. And most don't have an attorney representing them. So there's that difference reflected there as well. Okay, so we will continue, and hopefully more focus on the activism and solidarity around support for the asylum seekers at the border. It's Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker today talking about border politics.
Get back. I'm off my jack. Keep your hands off of my stack. Money, it's a hit. Don't give me that too good, good bullshit. I'm in the.
Yes, that was an excerpt from the song Money from the English progressive rock band Pink Floyd. Stay tuned for a review of the novel Girls Burn Brighter, about two very poor Indian girls who try to escape arranged marriages. or being sold into sexual slavery in order to live their love together. Also later, a discussion of political music on banking and finance, including talking about Pink Floyd and The Banks Are Made of Marble, is a really interesting story, as well as 16 Tons, which is a very interesting story. Next on The Mole, Suzanne Gordon. Welcome again to KABU.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Suzanne Gordon writes on medicine, on healthcare, on nursing, on medical systems. Her latest book is The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care. She's going to be discussing the book and veterans healthcare this Wednesday evening, 6 to 7:30 at the First Unitarian Church. And because of the hour, there's going to be refreshments and snacks. First Unitarian Church is in downtown Portland. She'll be discussing the political attack, the big predators and the hedge funds and the corporate set. They want to privatize the veterans' health care system and grab all of those dollars. She also discusses, however, the great achievements of the veterans' health care system, not very well known but real. She cites many studies and evaluations, like, for example, by the RAND Corporation and others, who are no friends of the left. They see veterans' health care as far superior to what private medicine and hospitals provide and could provide and will provide when they, if they are able to take it over. Suzanne is also going to be talking about the achievements that were made possible because veterans' health care is essentially a single-payer Medicare-for-all system. Suzanne, give us a sense of what you'll be discussing as to those achievements and why they occurred. Give people a sense of what you'll be talking about.
Sure. I think the veterans' healthcare system is important not only to veterans, but to anybody who's interested in a model of healthcare, which is desperately needed in this country, where people use evidence-based practice, where they use team-based primary care, where they integrate mental health and primary care, where doctors and nurses and PTs and other clinicians, psychologists don't have an incentive to over-treat or over-diagnose because they're on salary. So really, there's incredible palliative and hospice care. The VA practically invented geriatrics, teaches 70% of medical residents and trainees, about 40% of the nation's psychologists, tons of nurses and PTs and occupational therapists. So it's really a critical training agency for the nation's healthcare workforce, as well as developing models of care that really we should all enjoy. Home care. I mean, one could go on and on about the Veterans Health Administration achievements and accomplishments, which sadly the media doesn't focus on. And because, largely because of the conservative Koch brothers and hedge fund billionaires like Stephen Cohn, who want to privatize healthcare, who think government can do no good, who want to get the government out of everything. And so really, a lot of people think that the issues in the veterans healthcare privatization attempt are veteran only, that they only concern veterans, but they really concern us all. And another thing I'm going to be talking about is the new bill that's in Congress now, which is a privatization bill, which we all need to fight. So I hope people will come. I'm also going to be speaking at the OHSU Nursing School and Medical School on 8 o'clock in the Nursing School Auditorium on Wednesday morning about the stake that healthcare providers have in this fight against VA privatization.
Suzanne, I'm looking forward to it. The evening session I'll be coming to, it's at 6 o'clock at the First Unitarian Church. It's in downtown Portland on 12th Avenue, 6 o'clock to 7:30 with snacks and refreshments. Suzanne, thanks so much for all the work you've done, and see you Wednesday evening.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Bill. Take care.
Next on The Mole, we have a lot of music. We'll play some of it later. Larry Bolden discusses the novel Girls Burn Brighter. Larry, you're on.
Good morning. Shobha Rao's 2018 novel Girls Burn Brighter is the story of two very poor Indian girls who become fast friends. And once they are separated, they spend much of the rest of their lives looking for one another. The two girls, Poornima and Savitha, just a year or two apart. Quoting from the book, At 15, poor Nima came of marriageable age, and she stopped going to convent school. She began to sit at the spinning wheel, the charka, in her free time to help the household. That she, a girl, could earn anything at all lent her such a deep and abiding feeling of importance, of worth, that she sat at the charka every chance she got. Their hut had no electricity, so her spinning was a race against the sun. Close quote. At 16, poor Nima's mother dies, and she's promised in marriage to a farmer from another village. Again quoting, after a family death, it was inauspicious to have a celebration of any sort, let alone a wedding, for a full year. It had been 2 months since her mother's death. In another 10, her father was saying, she would be married. Close quote. Savitha comes into Purnima's life because her father takes her on as a helper now that there is one charka in the house free for use. Quote, Savitha was quiet around Purnima at first. She was a year or two older, Purnima guessed, though neither knew their exact ages. Only the birth dates of the boys were recorded in the village. Close quote. Purnima's father tells a story about how, when she was a baby, she had wandered into the river. Within seconds, she was up to her neck. Her mother panicked, and her father chased after her. Quoting, when I got near the waterline, though, he said, I stopped. I know I should have plucked her up and given her a slap, but I couldn't. You see, he said, she looked like she was nothing, just a piece of debris. In that mist, in that gray, in that vast, slippery rush of water, she looked like nothing. Maybe the head of a fish tossed back in the water. I looked at her. He said, I looked and I looked and I could hear her mother shouting, running toward me, but I couldn't move. I was standing there and I was thinking, she's just a girl. Let her go. By then, her mother came up from behind me and she snatched her out. Purnima was crying, he said. Her mother was crying too. Maybe they both knew what I thought. Maybe it was written on my face. And then her father had let out a little laugh. That's the thing with girls, isn't it? He'd said. Whenever they stand on the edge of something, you can't help it. You can't. You think, push. That's all it would take, just one push. Before Purnima is shipped off to her new family, Savitha is raped by Purnima's father, and since that means she is ruined in the village, there appears to be no future for her at all. The village men decide that justice requires Purnima's father to marry Savitha. Before that marriage can take place, Savitha disappears from the village, and little attempt is made to find her. Purnima's new husband disgusts her, and his family sees her as unworthy, eventually shipping her back to her village. Of course, the only thing Savitha has that she can sell to survive is her body, and she is soon in the hands of a brothel keeper named Guru. Turns out she has a skill for math and eventually keeps the books for Guru. All of the rest of this beautifully written but heartbreaking novel is taken up with Purnima's search for Savitha, a search that takes her to many places and eventually to Seattle in the USA. Both girls end up in brothels, getting by only through the use of their bodies. While Savitha's skill with numbers increases her status with the brothel keeper, there is no way to freedom. Quote, Savitha was seated in front of his desk, but she still slumped. She was tired. She was tired of deals. Every moment in a woman's life was a deal for her body, first for its blooming, then for its wilting, first for her bleeding, then for her virginity, then for her bearing, counting only sons, and then for her widowing. Close quote. It's hard not to focus on the horrible details of these girls' servitude, but there are also wonderful passages about the love between them and the hope that somehow, some way, they can be reunited and free. Purnima is badly burned at one point, and her scars are yet another reason for people to shun her. As she discovers that a girl she is trying to help is afraid of the help because of Purnima's scars, quoting from the book once more, she felt something rise inside her, something bitter, something angry, and she spit out, "You fool!" She heard the girl back away from the door. "You fool!" she cried again, and heard the girl whimper. "What a fool you are," she thought, fuming. "What fools we all are, we girls. Afraid of the wrong things at the wrong times. Afraid of a burned face when outside waiting for you, are fires you cannot imagine. Men holding matches up to your gasoline eyes. Flames all around you, licking at your just-born breasts, your just-bled body. And infernos as wide as the world, waiting to impoverish you, make you ash. And even the wind, my dear," she thought, "watching you burn, willing it, passing over you and through you, scattering you because you are a girl and because you are ash." Close quote. Finally, hot on Savitha's trail in Seattle, They are so close to finding each other again, but will they? You'll have to find out for yourselves by reading this wonderful debut novel I've been talking about, Shobha Rao's novel, Girls Burn Brighter. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, that was Money, 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 Money. Really only three of them.
The Love of Money by the OJs.
For the Love of Money by the OJs, and that was Jeffrey Hunt, who's our music mole. Before we get into talking about popular music and songs and politics and banking and finance and this whole system that preys on all of us, actually, some of the preying on us is visible. Most of it is invisible. We'll be talking about that, too. That was the OJs, Jeffrey Hunt. Thanks a lot for finding all those songs and finding so many others.
Yeah, thank you for having me back. And, I really enjoy these things.
And Jeffrey, he really knows music, the aesthetics, and the message of songs. He also knows audio and audio devices, how to keep them in tip-top condition, and he volunteers at KABU to do just that. He's basically if I may say so, you can disagree with me, Jeff.
Okay.
he's basically a millennial lefty. You know, it's the generation that has partially reversed the favorability ratings of socialism and capitalism. Capitalism used to be beloved, and socialism was a dirty word. And socialism is rapidly gaining ground, especially amongst those millennials.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jeffrey, you've had a lifelong interest in political songs, and since some time looking for songs about banking, money, debt finance. Give us some of your observations.
I think what was really obvious to me is that there are lots and lots of pop songs, top 40 mainstream songs, etc., that glamorize money, that make it seem sexy, that just go on. There's a lot of songs in hip-hop, of course, about the pursuit of money. There's tons of songs in just about every genre, really, about looking for money, getting money, and how wonderful it is getting money. But when you talk about how much money and the finance system and the banks and so on, how much control they have over us, that's a bit harder to find. There are songs that are out there, and in fact, we have four or five today, but in terms of ratio, they're relatively scarce compared to the number of songs glamorizing money.
Is that right?
Yeah.
The number of songs glamorizing money are greater than the...
I mean, this is all empirical evidence,
uh-huh.
You know, based on my research, but, you know, again, being a lifelong music listener, I'm in my mid-30s, over all these years, I can't really think of too many popular songs that talk about the dark side of money, debt, and so on. There's lots of songs in different underground genres, in punk rock, and hip-hop, and there's definitely lots of country songs about debt.
A lot of country and folk. But that, mm-hmm. those reach a whole lot of people, it seems to me.
Yeah.
And some of them then break through.
Some of them break through.
Like Tennessee Ernie's. Tennessee Ernie's was done, of course, by Merle Travis.
Yeah, and it's Tennessee Ernie's version that made it popular.
In 1955. That's partly because Merle Travis's was obviously a coal miner's song,
mm-hmm.
and the bare essentials in folk. He's playing the guitar and singing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Tennessee Ernie's was really
it's kind of slick, it's a little polished,
with the clarinet,
yeah.
and all of the, but it was still,
yeah.
that song. Although I thought his voice, there was a sort of a contrast between his voice and the meaning. I owe my soul to the
company
store.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I owe
my soul to the company.
I mean, he has a very smooth, very sweet,
very
sonorous voice.
Yeah, very ingratiating sort of.
Yeah, it's almost kind of croony, kind of lounge singer-esque.
Yeah,
and, you know, actually, I found a video on YouTube last night. The title of the video was 16 Tons, The Go-Go Version. And he's on some variety show. It's in black and white, so I would say, 50s, 60s, I'm not quite sure. And there's these, you know, very pretty women behind him dancing,
Yes. In sync. 16 times.
Yeah, those were, I guess, the go-go dancers. But, you know, it's kind of sort of beatnik-y, jazzy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, Travis found himself a good melody. Tennessee Ernie did it. What about the Banks of Marble that we played? You know, I looked up the history of it. It's really interesting. It was written actually in 1948 by a fellow named Les Rice, who was a farmer in upstate New York who lived near Pete Seeger. Although Les Rice had a name for himself and in music, especially among small farmers in the Northeast. And in fact, Les Rice was the president of the Ulster County Farmers Union. Did you know there were farmers unions? Small farmers got together, and this was right after the Second World War.
Well, I know
War.
About farmers cooperatives and so yeah, on, because my folks come from Iowa, so... But oh, yeah. I don't know about unions specifically.
Yeah, well, the unions were the smaller farmers, and they were getting squeezed, of course, by the banks who lent them money, and by the middlemen who paid very little for their produce, and there were only so many middlemen. So there were many, many farmers and a few middlemen and then a few banks, and the banks took part of their money, the middlemen took the others, and they were perennially near bankruptcy. It was like the populist revolt in the early part of the century in the Great Plains. You know, those people began fighting. It was the railroads that were also stealing from the farmers.
Absolutely,
that is,
and
they really faced constant bankruptcy. But anyway, Les Rice wrote this song, "The Banks Are Made of Marble," and Pete Seeger lived near him up there, and Les Rice would perform the song, you know, at farmers' get-togethers, right?
Yeah,
and so Pete Seeger picked it up, and then much of the left. Not much of the left. A lot of the left picked it up, like the Weavers did it. But of course, Pete Seeger was part of the Weavers. But Leonard Cohen did a version.
Yeah.
Who else did versions of it? A lot of people actually.
I don't recall off the top of my head.
They were all lefties. If I can, well, I don't remember.
Yeah.
But you should remember, Bill.
You'd hope they'd be on the left at least. Otherwise, it'd be very strange.
But the Banks are Utah Phillips, of course.
Yeah.
That was a great. That was one of his signature songs. But it did get out to the left, but it never got out to the left the way 16 Tons did. Merle Travis, who was a lefty.
Well, I think it's that bit about the slick production and the polished nature of it. I mean, the fact about the music industry and broadcasting and so on is that the more refined, better polished pieces get the widest coverage. They get played more. Who's a lesser-known artist or maybe a folky or something like that, you know, they play to a very limited audience because these days the big players would be, you know, Clear Channel, CBS or whatever. They wouldn't play stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they might play a slicked-up version of a quasi-protest song or what have you, you know.
You know what I've just noticed? We are running out of time.
Oh, goodness.
I thought we had so much time. And therefore, I'm going to launch into many thank yous to all the people who are on the show, including you.
You are welcome.
Jeffrey Hunt and to our wonderful engineer. And thank them and the musicians that we played. And thanks to all of you out there who support this station. Finally, you can hear this show or any part of it again or any of our previous shows or recommend us to your friends. Tell them to go to the web to KABU and go to the top right, the search box. Type Old Mole or Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up very soon, by tomorrow, maybe even this afternoon. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Underground Perspective. I'm Bill Resnick, your host today, signing off for the Old Mole. See you next Monday. Thanks a lot for listening.